hope. If they have to starve for a year or two or a decade, it's the only way to save their industry. We're chucking a whole heritage. Fishing is the oldest industry in California. You have to go up the coast to appreciate the despair. Even then, you really can't. You just can't. Everyone's broke. Everyone's living off relatives or on welfare. This was pure plunder. It's basically like the bison and the Indians. The settlers and the hide hunters killed all the buffalo, so they didn't have to kill the Indians. The Indians couldn't survive without the buffalo. Now the cotton and alfalfa farmers killed most of the salmon, with some help from everyone else. I don't know if they consciously wanted to get us out of the way. As long as we have salmon, we'll have fishermen. And as long as there are fishermen, they're going to be a pain in the ass. But a destitute fishing industry isn't a lobby. It's no one's constituency. It's just a sentimentality. All we have now, besides Miller Bradley, is the Endangered Species Act. I don't know how long it's going to last. If the growers had the political power to get all the water they wanted when California was drying up and blowing away, they might have figured that overturning the act, or seeing that it didn't affect their water supply, would be a piece of cake. On May 20th, 1979, an enormously tall, charismatic, and obsessed young man named Marc Dubois hiked into the canyon of the Stanislaus River, concealed himself near the river's edge, threw a length of chain around an undercut boulder, padlocked the ends of the chain together, tossed the key into the river, and leaned back against the boulder, waiting to drown. The flood that was going to submerge Marc Dubois within a day or two wasn't moving downriver from the thick snowfields melting rapidly in the Sierra Nevada. This was a flood moving in reverse, up the river. A few months earlier, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers had closed the gates of New Maloney's Dam, its most recent snub of nature, a mammoth rock pile wedged in Iron Canyon a few miles downriver. The reservoir had already submerged the older, much smaller Maloney's Dam and its reservoir, and now its tentacles of turbid water were creeping up the side creeks and the main river itself. Dubois had concealed himself somewhere in the Camp 9 Gorge, 9 miles of superlative Class 3 whitewater that could have been conceived by Disney World engineers on amphetamines. After the Youghiogheny River in Pennsylvania, it was the most popular rafting and kayaking run in the United States. Dubois, an expert boater and evangelical environmentalist, was a sort of fixture on this river that old Harry Truman was on the slopes of Mount St. Helens before it buried him in volcanic ash. He could hardly think of the Stanislaus River without thinking of Marc Dubois. He had invested 10 years of his life battling New Maloney's Dam, and for a while it almost looked as if he might win. But in the '70s, in a contest with the Corps, the Bureau of Reclamation, and California's unquenchable irrigation lobby, he and his minions really had no chance. They were the cavalry. He was the Sioux. The chain and padlock were his wounded knee. By then, the Corps' regional hierarchy knew Dubois almost intimately and chose not to undervalue his inhuman will. If he said he was prepared to die, he probably was. Within 30 hours, the spill gates of the dam were opened, and a posse of searchers combed the river canyon on foot, by helicopter and in rafts, trying to find his hiding spot. Even though some of them must have passed within a few yards of it, they did not. Meanwhile, the whole story had blown around the world. Dubois was being compared to the monks who incinerated themselves in Vietnam, and reporters and people from all over the place were roaring toward the Stanislaus to see what the fuss was all about. I was one of the first of them, and probably for the only time in my life I saw a river born again. A short distance below the old Parrott's Ferry Bridge, where 80,000 boaters had hauled out in the river's final year, was a small bouncy rapids, an effervescence of frothy jumping haystack waves. On the morning of May 21st, the reservoir was beginning to eat through them. I sat on the bank and watched. One after another, the big waves flattened out, their booming stilled, their splashing stopped. Then they disappeared under gurgling little whirlpools, and where there had been rapids minutes earlier, the river went dead calm. Late that day, however, the core began spilling the reservoir, and as it receded, the rapids began to reappear. First there was still water, then the water began to move, then it grew riffly and agitated, and then the rapid waves began rising up, gaining height, gaining force, splashing and spraying and churning as they had for thousands of years. Suddenly, from one minute to the next, there was a river again, but not for long. Jerry Brown, who was governor at the time, decided to intercede personally with Mark Dubois, promising to try to hold the reservoir below the Paris Ferry Bridge. And Dubois, who had told the single emissary where he was and given him a padlock key, walked out of his hiding place. Between its clenched teeth, the Corps mumbled something about respecting the will of the governor of a sovereign state, which was its way of saying it would just wait everyone out. During 1982, the heavy rains and snows of the late 1970s returned. The Corps and the Bureau's constituency, mostly conservative farmers in Republican towns with a God-given right to subsidized water and power and free flood control, staged demonstrations in Sacramento after releases from New Maloney's dam overtopped the river levees and began flooding their fields. Jerry Brown, possessing one of the shortest attention spans of any politician who ever lived, soon lost interest in the whole mess. The Bureau of Reclamation, which was supposed to market the water in the reservoir the Corps got to build, complained about all the waste, even though it hadn't signed a single contract to sell any of the water and had no means of getting it to any of the growers who allegedly wanted it. But this only meant that if the reservoir was filled, Southern California, by default, had a new water supply. What did a bunch of rafters matter, stacked against this? New Maloney's Lake had filled all of Camp Nine Gorge by the following spring. Another river that had flowed wild for hundreds of thousands of years was a memory. Coincidentally or not, however, the filling of New Maloney's Lake brought the first age of dams to a close, at least in the American West. In California, virtually nothing has been built since. It has been the same everywhere else. The Narrows Dam in Colorado, Orme Dam in Arizona, the Garrison Project in North Dakota, O'Neill Dam in Nebraska, Auburn Dam, the North Coast Dams, none of the projects whose construction seemed likely when I began writing this book exists. There has been no Nawapa-scale apotheosis. It's hardly mentioned anymore. The dam-building machine didn't even coast down like a turbine going off-peak. It just suddenly fell apart. So many factors have played a role that it's hard to judge which mattered most. You have to give some credit to Mark Dubois. Like Rosa Parks climbing defiantly aboard her segregated bus, he started something that couldn't be quelled. Millions of people who had never seen the Stanislaus River found themselves feeling upset, if not infuriated, over its loss. Among environmentalists, remember the Stanislaus is what Stay the Course was to the Reagan faithful. Meanwhile, river recreation, rafting, kayaking, fishing, just watching the river go, boomed all through the 80s in a way that hauling a sinister, gas-guzzling fighter jet of a motorboat to the local mudflat did not. Wallace Stegner estimates that about 5,000 Americans who were alive in the 1930s had ever floated a whitewater river. By the early 1990s, 35 million had. Rafting is fairly big business in states like Colorado, where whitewater companies advertise on billboards that once promoted agricultural chemicals, shale oil development, or Wayne Aspinall. Having a captive audience helps. A couple of days spent floating a beautiful threatened river can turn whole families into environmental radicals where the fate of that river is concerned. But the water lobby itself deserves most of the credit for its sudden drought of opportunities. Back in the days when most members of Congress cheerfully voted for each other's dams, the best sites disappeared as fast as the rivers on which the dams were built. By the 80s, you were left with ludicrous projects like the Narrows Dam, where you had to build a subsurface dam twice as large as the one above ground in order to stop the river from seeping out underneath. A full-size Lake Auburn, which could hold 2,400,000 acre-feet of water, but would deliver only 200 or 300,000 acre-feet a year because most of the American River is already captured and appropriated. Auburn Dam would need awesome runoff in order to fill up and remain full. Is projected to cost about $2 billion, which means it will cost twice as much. Hoover Dam, which captures 30 million acre-feet of water and routinely delivers 9 or 10 million acre-feet a year, was completed in 1936 for $48 million, million and change. If you are the Bureau of Reclamation, you are left trying to justify a dam that would yield 3% of Hoover's water and perhaps 8% of its power and cost 10 times more in uninflated dollars. You also have to explain why you are building a gigantic dam next door to a presumably active earthquake fault. Finding the money to erect pyramids such as this was no problem for the pharaohs who ran Congress 30 or 40 years ago, when the whole federal budget was smaller than the portion that pays interest every year on a $4 trillion national debt. But today, when a clutch of visionaries representing Utah water districts troops into the U.S. Capitol to lobby for some new taxpayer-financed dam, they get the same response the departing bunch from Texas just received. It's conceivable, that Congress might find a little money for the project if the local sponsors agree to pay, let us say, one half of the cost up front. That is how water projects that are a matter of life or death become projects a region can live without. But the thorniest desert in which today's water lobby finds itself wandering is the ecological legacy of its predecessors. By erecting 30,000 dams of significant size across the American West, they dewatered countless rivers, wiped out millions of acres of riparian habitat, shut off many thousands of river miles of salmon habitat, silted over spawning beds, poisoned return flows with agricultural chemicals, set the plague of livestock loose on the arid land. In a nutshell, they made it close to impossible for numerous native species to survive. So today, if you want to erect a dam on any tributary of the Colorado River, you have to worry about its effects on the squawfish, a federally listed endangered species. If you want to siphon more fresh water out of the Sacramento-San Joaquin River Delta, you have to ponder the effect on the spring and winter run Chinook salmon, on the nearly vanished striped bass, an introduced species but one with a big and tough sport fishing lobby, on the Delta smelt, a serious candidate for listing under the Endangered Species Act, and on 24, 36, who knows how many land-based species whose precarious hold on existence might be lost through the conversion of remnant deserts or marshes or grasslands to crops or of fecund estuaries into sterile saltwater sumps. The fiercest environmental battles of the 1990s are likely to be fought in the American West, and many of them, most of them, may to one degree or another involve the Endangered Species Act. But some would be fought even if that act were written out of law. The battles over salmon in California will probably seem as nothing compared to those in the Northwest, because there salmon are a real industry. The Columbia River's commercial and sport fishery is valued in the many hundreds of millions of dollars a year. The Columbia was once the greatest salmon river in the world. 15 million fish returned every year to spawn. Today, there are fewer than 2 million. And half of the watershed salmon runs, dozens in all, are in fairly imminent danger of going extinct. What it all boils down to is undoing the wrongs caused by earlier generations doing what they thought was right. The Bureau of Reclamation and the Corps of Engineers knew that their dams would ruin the Columbia River fishery, or most of it, as the years and decades went by. But they convinced themselves, and the Congress, and for that matter, most people living in the Pacific Northwest, that all the new power and water was worth the price. It was simply how everyone thought, then. In 1967, in order to be ready for Vice President Hubert Humphrey, who was coming out to dedicate John Day Dam and who wanted to feel the thrum of its turbines, the Corps closed the dam gates before the fish ladders were operational, condemning a migration of hundreds of thousands of salmon and steelhead to death. The Vice President's schedule couldn't be changed. The Corps, a perfect representative of its era, never bothered to ask whether the same might be true of the fish. By the 70s, however, America's values were utterly different, because everyone's experiences had changed. People who came through the Depression didn't just eat salmon, they survived on it, and they were sick of it. It was known as poverty steak because it sold for 10 cents a pound. Those who were born later could only listen to stories of rivers you could cross on the backs of salmon, of creeks where they crowded themselves out of the water and flopped into the woods. Suddenly, there was plenty of cotton and fruit grown on irrigation water. There was plenty of cheap steak, because subsidized water was raising millions of cattle on irrigated alfalfa and grass. There was plenty of cheap hydroelectricity, just 2 or 3 generations after the Depression, when many rural towns in the West had no electricity at all. All things man-made had become plentiful, but a great menu of things once abundant in nature had become scarce. And now people were demanding some of it back. It didn't seem possible when I began writing this book, but by now it is beginning to seem plausible after all. After damming the canyons and dewatering the rivers in order to spill wealth on the land, we are going to take some of the water back and put it where, one could argue, as more and more Westerners now do, it really belongs. Law has been the ignition, but a great, almost epical shift in values has worked as the engine of change. In the mid-80s, after being hammered by a landmark public trust decision, the city of Los Angeles reduced its diversions from the streams feeding Mono Lake by 60,000 acre-feet a year. The level of the lake, a vast salty haven for migratory waterfowl, began to stabilize after dropping dramatically over 40 years. A few years later, the city actually returned some water to the Owens River, which began to flow again for the first time in almost half a century. It didn't flow as it once did, but at least you could call it a river again. It flowed out of new history. William Mulholland was dead. The board of his Department of Water and Power had been all but taken over by environmentalists. The mayor of Los Angeles, Tom Bradley, said with genuine contrition that he wanted to repair some of the damage his city had done. It was the same everywhere. In 1992, the newly appointed Commissioner of Reclamation, Dennis Underwood, hailed not from Bountiful, Utah, or Orchard City, Colorado, but from Santa Monica. His new regional director in California, Roger Patterson, had just decided to dedicate outflows from Folsom Lake to the California Delta instead of cotton farmers and was holding hundreds of thousands of acre-feet in Shasta Lake for the sake of fish instead of alfalfa. Patterson said he looked forward to implementing the just-passed Central Valley Project Reform Act, legislation that might have prompted Floyd Dominey to resign in disgust. After all, he had acquired a much more important constituency, a public that was beginning to wonder why such an agency even exists, and a loaded gun called the Endangered Species Act was aimed at his head. Even in the Northwest, where the sheer size of the dams and the sheer value of hydroelectricity make change terrifically difficult, it almost has to occur. You can perhaps imagine California salmon going extinct, but you can imagine no such thing in the Pacific Northwest, a region the salmon very nearly symbolizes. The great mainstem dams will never be torn down, but smaller dams may be. The federal government already has plans to purchase a high dam on the Elwha River, which drains the north side of the Olympic Range and hosts all 5 species of Pacific salmon, in order to tear it down. And the mainstem dams, at a cost of hundreds of millions of dollars, will be re-engineered in order to block fewer adult salmon and pass more juveniles through. Holes may be punched through their immense solid insides and then sealed with ponderous metal gates. When the fish are running downriver, the gates may be opened to let them pass without becoming chopped liver in the turbines. The river may be managed, for better or worse, it is in human hands, in a completely different way. The reservoirs rapidly drawn down to quicken the current, the gates opened for the fish, the whole process repeated again and again, water tumbling down a ladder, until each successive run is safely at sea. 40 years ago, only a handful of heretics, howling at the wilderness, challenged the notion that the West needed hundreds of new dams. Today, they are almost vindicated. There is more talk of deconstruction than of construction, of minor dams demolished, of big dams made environmentally sound, of marginal acreage retired and water returned to its source, of flows bypassing turbines to flush salmon and steelhead out to sea. How can this happen? The region's population is growing and in places exploding. California has added 7 million people since New Maloney's dam. More people need more water and power and food. Asia sends its surplus population to California and the Northwest. The Mexican border is porous as a sieve. It's only recently, mainly in the years since this book first appeared, that Westerners have begun to ask where their water goes, what it costs, and what it earns. That inquiry may produce the most revolutionary results since the Reclamation Act. In California, for example, enough water for Greater Los Angeles was still being used in 1986 to raise irrigated pasture for livestock. A roughly equal amount, enough for 20 million people at home, at play, and at work, was used that year to raise alfalfa, also for horses, sheep, and mainly cows. The more one tries to make sense of this, the less success one has. Feeding irrigated grass to cows is as wasteful a use of water as you can conceive. Pasture is hydrologically inefficient in the extreme, and metabolically speaking, so are cows. You need 7 or 8 feet of water in the hot deserts to keep grass alive, which means that you need almost 50,000 pounds of water to raise 1 pound of cow. Feeding alfalfa to cows requires even more water, but at least alfalfa fixes nitrogen in the soil. If the livestock industry earned California real money, and if cows, unlike avocados or artichokes, couldn't be raised on rainfall in 35 other states, then giving more water to cows than to humans in the nation's richest and most populous state, a semi-desert state at the mercy of a precarious water supply, might make a grain or two of sense. In 1985, however, the pasture crop was worth about $100 million, while Southern California's economy was worth $300 billion, but irrigated pasture used more water than Los Angeles and San Diego combined. When you added cotton, a price-supported crop worth about $900 million that year, to alfalfa and pasture, you had a livestock industry and a cotton industry consuming much more water than everyone in urban California and producing as much wealth in a year as the urban economy rings up in 3 or 4 days. Rice, another crop that needs lots of water, consumed more than the entire Bay Area, but the state's rice acreage supports much of the Pacific Flyway on waste grain and an enormous winter production of invertebrate food, so I am leaving the rice acreage alone. It isn't much different in any other western state. In Colorado, the alfalfa crop is worth a couple of $100 million a year, while tourism is worth about $5 billion a year. To raise alfalfa, you have to dam, dewater, and otherwise destroy the rivers that many of the tourists come to fish, to raft, or simply to see. The hydroelectricity that could be generated downriver by water used to raise alfalfa is potentially worth more than the crop. In Idaho, the money crop is potatoes, but the crops that use most of the state's water are alfalfa and grass. Each cow raised in the Columbia River watershed, where millions of cows are raised, indirectly consumes water for several salmon. Then the cow pollutes the rivers, overgrazes the hillsides, erodes the stream banks, and conspires, beyond the workings of its feeble brain, to ruin the fish and their habitat in other ways, for example, by sending forth acres of methane-rich flatulence that hasten the greenhouse effect. In an arid or semi-arid region, you can irrigate low-value, thirsty crops such as alfalfa and pasture grass only if you have cheap water. If your fields are riparian, or if your dams and aqueducts were built decades ago, or if you get your water subsidized by the taxpayers, as one of every three of the Far West full-time irrigation farmers does, if you need 40 or 50,000 pounds of water in places like California and Colorado to irrigate enough fodder to raise $2 worth of cow, you can't even consider it if 40,000 pounds of water costs $7 or $8, as it would if you bought it from the California Water Project. But it makes perfectly good sense if the government sells you the same quantity for 30 or 40 cents, as it does if the Central Valley Project is your source. If free market mechanisms, which much of Western agriculture publicly applauds and privately abhors, were actually allowed to work, the West's water shortage would be exposed for what it is, the sort of shortage you expect when inexhaustible demands chases an almost free good. If someone were selling Porsches for $3,000 apiece, there would be a shortage of those too. California has a shortage of water because it has a surfeit of cows. It's really almost as simple as that. The urban areas in the West have been slow to recognize all this, but lately they have begun to recognize it with a vengeance. The Metropolitan Water District is flooding its millions of customers with literature that shows how 1,000 acre-feet of water used in high-tech industry can create 16,000 jobs, and how the same 1,000 acre-feet of water used on pasture farms creates 8 jobs. 8. This kind of stuff infuriates the San Joaquin Valley, its erstwhile ally in the water wars, so Valley mouthpieces respond in a manner that inspires the Met not just to anger, but to retribution. All the old alliances are falling apart. Southern California wants nothing more to do with the San Joaquin. Its water barons would rather scheme over sushi with environmentalists, because they represent the new nexus of power. Even the rice growers in the Sacramento Valley want little to do with the San Joaquin Valley. They raise lots of waterfowl food on acreage that the birds of the Pacific Flyway have come to depend on, and most conservationists now acknowledge that fact, and some have even begun to like rice. So why should the rice industry, which gets little subsidized water, carry the San Joaquin Valley's hog? Meanwhile, all kinds of new alliances are beginning to form. The Sacramento Valley has its own water lobby, which has begun to hold meetings with the salmon fishermen, searching for solutions to their water shortage, which is devastatingly real. Las Vegas and Reno, which represent 95% of Nevada's economy but use 10% of its water, alfalfa growers use most of the rest, may fight like hyenas over monstrous gambling palaces that Japanese companies want to build, but they are in sweet accord on water policy. The new chief of the Las Vegas Valley Water District, a forceful woman named Patricia Mulroy, the murdered hero in Chinatown had the same last name, also happens to be chairman of a new Washington lobby group representing most of the urban water agencies in the western states. Its agenda is simple. More water for cities, more for the environment, and less for agriculture, especially water-gorging low-value agriculture, which usually means cows. It's not really the irrigator's water, says an urban water agency lobbyist, still too cautious to let me use his name. It belongs to the people of the states. They have allowed the growers to put all that water to a reasonable and beneficial use. But those words could mean something entirely different in the future. What's so reasonable and beneficial about ruining salmon rivers to raise subsidized surplus crops while industries that employ lots of people decide to relocate to wetter states? The irrigation lobby still has a few things going for it, mainly sentimentality, tradition, and law. In many western states, it's the irrigation districts that set water policy. They can forbid sales of water rights from farms to cities beyond the district boundaries, and many of them do. And the irrigation lobby still has a few people convinced that if it doesn't get almost all the region's water, then the whole world will starve. But the growers and their allies, anyone who wants to build more dams, are fighting a rearguard battle, and they know it. A number of states have legitimized water transfers, and a number of others, notably California, are going too soon. With George Miller now presiding over the House Interior Committee, the growers may be lucky to get any more subsidized federal water at all. The West's real crisis is one of inertia, of will, and of myth. As Wallace Stegner wrote, somehow the cow and the cowboy and the irrigated field came to symbolize the region, instead of the bison and the salmon and the antelope that once abounded here. Stegner said that he spent much of his writing career breaking lances against windmills turned by the cowboy mystique. You needn't even get rid of the cowboys, who add color and relief to a culture that is becoming depressingly urbanized and, worse, suburbanized. But they might be driving bison in reasonable numbers instead of cows, and raising them, for the most part, on unirrigated land, which bison tolerate far better than cows. In a West that once and for all made sense, you might import a lot more meat and dairy products from states where they are raised on rain rather than dream of importing those states' rain. You would have a West where most people live in contained cancers called cities, as they already do anyway, and where more rural people would provide the opportunities for people from the cities, for people from all over the world, to enjoy the region's splendors as they once were. A region where people begin to recognize that water left in rivers can be worth a lot more in revenues and jobs than water taken out of the rivers. Maybe even a region where a lot of people really don't give a damn how much money a river can produce. At some point, perhaps within my lifetime, the American West will go back to the future rather than forward to the past. Mark Reisner, October 1992.
Postscript to the revised edition. The West, save for its northern reaches, is America's desert. Capturing and transporting water to its arid regions fueled the rapid development of agriculture and urban centers. Until the last quarter of the last century, running out of water wasn't a concern. There was always another supply to divert. When first published in 1986, Cadillac Desert upended that notion by illuminating how precarious the American West's water supply was, something few people knew at the time. In the 30 years since this book was written, climate change, drought, and population growth have made our water supply even more vulnerable. And that's not all that has changed. Just about everything has changed. Some for the good, some not, including the surprising ascension of Donald Trump, whose administration could have an enormous impact on what happens far across the continent from the president's permanently verdant, although at risk from rising sea levels, Mar-a-Lago. This 2017 postscript to the 1993 edition of Cadillac Desert briefly updates Western water issues during the last two decades. The mighty Colorado River is stretched to its limits, though many efforts of cooperation and collaboration hold promise for the future. Dwindling wild salmon stocks could rebound when more dams are removed. California's water infrastructure, built in the 20th century, is being severely tested by the 21st century reality of long drought followed by extreme deluge. The challenged Colorado River. From a well-positioned commercial jet at 35,000 feet, fortunate passengers in the window seats can't miss the white bathtub ring left by the receding water of Lake Mead. This calcified stripe between the reddish-brown volcanic rocky slopes of the reservoir and the shimmering deep blue surface of the remaining water is 145 feet tall, about the height of the Statue of Liberty. Dramatic evidence of 16 consecutive years of drought in the Colorado River Basin, the worst in a millennium. When Mark wrote the afterword, the ring was only one-third as high. Surprisingly, perhaps, this year's massive winter rains and snows throughout much of the West will not do much to reverse the huge accumulated shortage in Lake Mead. They might shrink the bathtub ring a few feet. Looking ahead, climate change will inexorably impact the region. The Colorado River Basin has warmed by 2 degrees Fahrenheit in the last century. Warmer temperatures caused by climate change could reduce Colorado River flows by 50% by the end of the century. Adding insult to injury, more precipitation will come as rain rather than snow. Snowmelt will be earlier and evaporation more rapid. Regardless how long this current drought lasts, scientists using climate models and 1,000 years of tree ring data predict an 80% likelihood of another mega drought in the watershed in the second half of this century. Simply put, and without exaggeration, the Colorado River is in extreme water crisis, and this isn't going to abate anytime soon. The economic, social, and political consequences will be profound. Stretching more than 1,450 miles from the peaks of the Rocky Mountains through the arid Southwest and into Mexico, the Colorado River is the lifeblood for 40 million people in 7 western states and across the border in Mexico. A number of the country's largest, fastest-growing, and inherently driest cities, Los Angeles, San Diego, Phoenix, Tucson, Denver, and Las Vegas, all depend on the river. And the residents of the region use only 30% of the water pulled from the Colorado system. Agriculture still hogs 70%, enough to irrigate 5.5 million acres. The river also generates more than 4,000 megawatts of clean, if you ignore the devastation caused by building dams, and vital hydroelectric power. Even before the new reality of a hotter and drier future, the Colorado River was over-allocated. Layers of negotiations, court decisions, treaties, government rules, and more, collectively known as the Law of the River, prescribe how the water is divided between the upper basin states of Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, and New Mexico, the lower basin states of Nevada, Arizona, and California, and eventually Mexico. Still enforced as the basis for all water deliveries, the 1922 allocations total 16.5 million acre feet, numbers based on an extremely wet period 100 years ago. During this latest drought, the river has been flowing at a rate of around 12.4 million acre feet. This number is almost certain to decline. No one can be certain how much, 5% by mid-century, maybe 35%? Even the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, traditionally bullish about water supplies, has acknowledged that climate change will reduce water flow in the Colorado River. In 2005, acknowledging the grim realities, Gail Norton, Secretary of the Interior during the administration of President George W. Bush, directed the Bureau of Reclamation to devise new management strategies for the inevitable water shortages on the horizon. The Bureau's power has waned considerably from its peak under the reign of Commissioner Floyd Dominey in the last century. But on the Colorado River, it is still the enforcer-in-chief. In the old days, it would simply have called for more dams, always more dams, to capture any greater than normal precipitation. But given the profound shortfalls, and with climate change now certain, that simplistic approach will no longer do. Even the Bureau understands this. Cooperation and collaboration are now necessary to share the pain. In 2007, representatives from the 7 basin states joined Dirk Kempthorne, Norton's successor as Secretary of the Interior, to sign new interim guidelines. The signing ceremony was held in Las Vegas, where betting against the odds is compulsory. This deal, effective until 2026, for the first time provides clarity by codifying exactly what happens with water allocations to the lower basin states during shortages. If on January 1st of any given year, the surface elevation of Lake Mead drops below 1,075 feet above sea level, Arizona and Nevada must begin reducing their use of the Colorado by 11% and 4%, respectively. California would still receive its full allocation of water, primarily because its water rights are senior to Arizona's due to a 1968 congressional deal to get the Central Arizona Project authorized. In a separate negotiation, Mexico agreed to reduce its use by 3.8%. Additional delivery reductions could occur should the unthinkable happen, and the lake drops to 1,050 feet or even 1,025 feet. Under the original Law of the River, the recipients of the Colorado's water had to use it or lose it. With the interim guidelines, the lower basin states of California, Arizona, and Nevada are allowed to bank for future use water produced through specifically approved projects, including land fallowing, canal lining, and seawater desalination. When the Bureau's commissioner declares that this intentionally created surplus, ICS, water is available, only when Lake Mead is above 1,075 feet, the lower basin states can call on their stored water. Each state has a prescribed maximum capacity for such storage, a restricted annual withdrawal, and an important 3% storage reduction each year to account for evaporation. Call this institutional water savings account insurance and motivation to conserve, even by California, which cooperated with its neighbor states to avoid the likely political and legal battles if it got its full deliveries while its neighbors did not. In June 2016, almost a decade after the new guidelines took over, Lake Mead fell to its lowest level ever, 1,071.64 feet above sea level. On January 1st, 2017, it was at 1,086 feet. 25 years ago, it was about 1,173 feet. Thus, the lake narrowly escaped the official shortage designation for another year. But the Bureau estimates about a 30% chance of hitting this benchmark in 2019, with a similar likelihood in the following 3 years. If this happens, water deliveries will be curtailed, even if we get lucky, and reservoir levels hover above 1,075 feet due to the exceptional, in both amount and frequency, winter snowfall and rains. Long-term comprehension conservation is called for. Everyone understands this. California, Arizona, Nevada, and the Bureau have been negotiating additional drought contingency plans with hope for an agreement. They did not succeed in 2016, and just 2 days before Trump's inauguration, then-Secretary of the Interior, Sally Jewell, issued a Hail Mary secretarial order directing staff to continue pursuing that all-important drought contingency plan. Who knows what effect this will have with the Trump administration, but one has to wish that all those years of collaboration do not go to waste. Cities have been at the forefront of this water conservation movement, and it's a good thing, because urban populations in the sunny Southwest have soared in recent decades. Between 1990 and 2010, the number of residents in the Las Vegas metro area nearly tripled to more than 2 million. In Phoenix, the population almost doubled to more than 4 million. Without exception, all the other large urban areas in the Colorado River Basin grew immensely. In addition, the river also supplies water to millions of people who live outside the actual watershed, from Cheyenne, Denver, and Albuquerque in the east to Salt Lake City, Los Angeles, San Diego, and Tijuana in the west. All are booming. The only reason the water situation has not already reached the apocalyptic stage is that these city residents now use far less water than in the past, 30% less in many cases. A remarkable achievement. Look at Las Vegas, the city of dreams, whose world-famous resorts with countless moats, fountains, cascading waterfalls, and enormous glittering swimming pools evoke the fantasy of a desert oasis only 45 minutes from Lake Mead. These resorts account for 80% of the region's economy, but consume only 8% of its water resources. The extravagant fountains at the Bellagio and the Grand Canal at the Venetian use recycled water. Every drop issuing from the city's dishwashers, sinks, showers, car washes, and even toilets is funneled through the sewer system into wastewater treatment facilities and then returned to the Colorado River and Lake Mead via the Las Vegas Wash. Allocations of the Colorado, as per the original law of the river, are consumptive, or net use. That is, they count only water removed from the river and not returned. Every gallon that is returned counts as credit against the allocation limit. Southern Nevada can, and actually does, pump much more water than its prescribed 300,000 acre feet per year. By the way, that number is very low, because the still operative 1922 Law of the River allocations grant 2.8 million acre feet to Arizona, 4.4 million acre feet to California, but only 0.3 million acre feet to Nevada, because modern Las Vegas did not exist at the time. The problem in Las Vegas and elsewhere is all the runoff that's not so easily recaptured and therefore counts against the allocation. The problem is grass. Some 70% of the water used in Vegas sustains lawns, parks, and golf courses that are alluring for the eye, without a doubt, but also stunningly, wastefully inappropriate for a desert landscape that averages 4 inches of rainfall a year. Since 2000, the Southern Nevada Water Authority has spent $200 million in rebates for replacing grass with desert landscapes. In many neighborhoods, cactus, rock gardens, and artificial turf are the new norm. Thanks to the rebate program, about 4,000 acres of lawn are history. And yet on other fronts, Vegas continues to flout its parched setting. The very pipes that return the treated water to Lake Mead run under the Lake Las Vegas community, a 3,600-acre Italianate development on a 320-acre man-made lake with 10 miles of shoreline. The website featured a photo of a gondolier propelling his iconic vessel across the placid water. The local Hilton Hotel, no doubt, intentionally resembles the Ponte Vecchio that spans Florence's Arno River. It takes considerable hubris to manufacture a new oasis during these fraught times in the desert. But Las Vegas was founded on such hubris. It's pretty much baked into the local DNA by now. Even with the successful, locally focused initiatives in Las Vegas and other metro areas, even with the new conservation incentives incorporated in the interim guidelines, the Colorado River simply will not be able to meet future needs. This was the sobering conclusion of the Colorado River Basin Water Supply and Demand Study, completed in December 2012 by the Bureau of Reclamation with the seven basin states and other stakeholders. Comparing different scenarios of water availability, factoring in climate change, population growth, and the resulting net demand, the study predicts a shortfall of 3.2 million acre-feet by 2060. The blandly named Basin Study was a defining moment for all. The Bureau acknowledged that the projected shortfalls could not be solved with conservation alone, nor with new dams or pipelines or other big-ticket concrete and steel construction. Instead, the answer is a broad and flexible portfolio of diverse water-saving projects at the local, state, regional, and basin-wide levels. 2 years after that bombshell study was released, the Central Arizona Project dropped a second one, with its report to that state legislature predicting a structural deficit of 1.2 million acre-feet each year between the water coming into Lake Mead and the promised deliveries to California, Arizona, Nevada, and Mexico, as well as losses to evaporation. Two studies, two sets of forbidding numbers, and in both cases, exceptional honesty, signaling a new era, with far deeper recognition of the river's limits and the need for new conservation measures. Cities are in the conservation lead, specifically the four largest cities that pull their drinking water from the big river. Their Colorado River System Conservation Program is paying farmers, industries, and municipalities to reduce their use. The fund was seeded initially in 2014 with $11 million, $3 million from the Bureau of Reclamation, and $2 million each from the Southern Nevada Water Authority, including Las Vegas, the Central Arizona Project, including Phoenix, the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California, including Los Angeles, and Denver Water. All water conserved will stay in the river system and help boost declining reservoir levels, with no credit given to any particular user. This innovative and cooperative approach encompasses both the upper and lower basins and props up Lake Powell, not just Lake Mead. Powell serves the four upper basin states. The first projects include converting farms from flood irrigation to drip systems, removing excess turf from golf courses, and improving infrastructure to increase return flows into the Colorado. The initial projects approved in the lower basin will collectively conserve 63,000 acre-feet at an average cost of $149 per acre-foot, dirt cheap compared to $2,000 for an acre-foot from a desalination plant. Based on the program's initial success, the Bureau, in early 2016, allocated up to $4 million for new projects. The four urban entities also contributed an additional $3 million to the program. On the other hand, coexisting with conservation is more infrastructure, always more dams and reservoirs. Among politicians and big building contractors, the allure is irresistible. One factor has changed, though. Neither the federal nor state governments will foot the bill. If any such project is built, those who receive the water must pay for its construction and operation, a pretty steep barrier to its completion. Even if the era of dam building is finished, construction from scratch, that is, Denver is pushing hard to get more water out of the Colorado by raising the height of a dam on a reservoir near Boulder. Some fast-growing urban areas are pursuing pipe dreams, long, expensive pipelines, and a few new dams to divert water for their residents. In Utah, state and local officials are proposing the Lake Powell Pipeline, currently estimated to cost at least $1 billion, maybe $2 billion, to be paid by residential water users in order to pump water through a 5-foot-wide pipe from Lake Powell to St. George, a fast-growing region in southwest Utah. That's 140 miles and 2,000 feet uphill. Utah is also dreaming about new reservoirs on the Bear River, which drains into the Great Salt Lake, to supply 220,000 acre-feet at an estimated $1.5 billion. New Mexico is still considering a proposal to divert the Gila River into a new reservoir. The latest plan is somewhat smaller than the original, but would still require paying the Gila River Indian community, downstream senior water rights holders in Arizona, for using their water. In California, Governor Jerry Brown is pushing hard to build two massive $17 billion tunnels under the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta. Las Vegas is busy building tunnels and pumps to allow access to Lake Mead's water should the level continue to drop. The city managers do not feel they can rely on conservation and luck alone, not when their city depends on the lake for 90% of its water. In December 2014, workers completed a 3-mile-long, 20-foot-in-diameter, $817 million tunnel into the lower reaches of Lake Mead. The new tunnel siphons water at the 860-foot level, assuring a steady water source should declining levels leave the two existing intakes. One sits at 1,050 feet above sea level, the other at 1,000 feet, sucking air instead. Water started flowing through the third straw in September 2015, and construction has started on a $650 million lower-level pumping station for the new intake that should be operational by 2020. The $1.5 billion spent on this new infrastructure should keep Las Vegas taps and waterfalls flowing. And there's more. Though stalled by the Nevada Supreme Court, the Southern Nevada Water Authority unbelievably continues to include in its portfolio of future resources an almost 300-mile pipeline to take groundwater pumped from rural valleys in central and eastern Nevada to Las Vegas. Cost? $15 billion. The agency has also deposited approximately 760,000 acre-feet in California and Arizona water banks, in accordance with the interim guidelines. The Las Vegas Valley groundwater basin stores an additional 360,000 acre-feet. Las Vegas may, in the end, have pretty good water odds. When the subject is water and infrastructure, the Central Arizona Project is necessarily front and center. CAP channels 1.5 million acre-feet of water per year from the Colorado River through more than 300 miles of canals to farmers, as well as the residents and businesses of Phoenix and Tucson. Some of these users are 3,000 feet uphill from the river. That's a steep ask. Water won't flow uphill to a height twice that of the Empire State Building without help from power, and a lot of it. In fact, CAP is the state's single largest end user of electricity, generated by the 40-year-old coal-fired Navajo Generating Station, located on the Navajo Nation Reservation in Page, Arizona, at the border with Utah, just a few miles from Lake Powell. Burning 22,000 tons of coal each day, that's 8 million tons per year, this behemoth produces 2,250 megawatts of electricity for Arizona, Nevada, and California. CAP uses about a quarter of that electricity, and 90% of it is required to push all that water uphill. Locally, the Navajo plant emits dangerous levels of particulate matter and mercury, affecting residents' health. Currently, it is among the top 10 sources of global warming carbon dioxide in the United States. Almost 2,000 local jobs depend on the plant. Yet this may all change very soon. In a surprising move, the four power companies that own the plant announced they will end operation in December 2019, decades earlier than expected. Record low natural gas prices outcompete electricity produced with coal. President Trump says he will bring back coal. Who knows what this means for the Navajo generating station? Burning coal to move water is antediluvian, rhetorically speaking. Why not cover the CAP canals with solar panels to generate electricity and reduce evaporation? 70% of CAP's 1.5 million acre-feet of water is dedicated to the state's agriculture. Hay, alfalfa, and cotton are the leading planted crops by acreage, and they are among the thirstiest farmers could choose. Flood irrigation is the common watering strategy. Sprinklers and drip irrigation use less water, but can be an expensive investment. Another option would be to plant alternate crops. The nonprofit Pacific Institute estimates that replacing 70,000 acres of cotton with wheat would save 90,000 acre-feet of water while putting none of these farmers out of business. Keeping all the alfalfa, but switching to more efficient, regulated deficit irrigation throughout the entire lower basin could save 800,000 acre-feet per year. Indeed, agriculture has great potential to reduce its water use, but is not likely to do so without incentive. One could be the Pilot Drought Response Actions Project, a December 2014 agreement between water agencies in California, Arizona, and Nevada. In Arizona, 9 irrigation districts near Phoenix have already agreed to forbear or give up 160,000 acre-feet of water over 2015 and 2016, nearly half of the total amount of water Arizona is hoping to put into Lake Mead in the first 2 years. The bulk of this farm water will come from the Central Arizona Project. The three states hope to save at least 1.5 million acre-feet of water by 2019. The program is just the latest result of the ongoing intense drought contingency plans among California, Arizona, and Nevada, and the Bureau of Reclamation. Everyone understands the necessity to look beyond the 2007 interim guidelines. This is real progress, given the old Wild West mentality of combat before compromise. The growing cooperation among the three states and their water agencies is an important positive sign in the world of Western water. In California's far southeastern corner, the Imperial Valley receives just 3 inches of rain each year, not much help for growing crops. On the other hand, the valley's irrigation district enjoys senior rights, before everyone else, to 3.855 million acre-feet of Colorado River water. That abundant and guaranteed water, flowing through the 83-mile-long All-American Canal, has transformed the brown desert into year-round fields of green for almost a century. San Diego and Los Angeles also depend on shipments of Colorado River water delivered by the 240-mile Colorado River Aqueduct. By the late 1990s, California was using more than its allocated share of the river. This couldn't go on, and when the Bureau of Reclamation demanded that the state live within its total designated allocation of 4.4 million acre-feet, the Southern California cities, whose water rights were junior to the Imperial Valley's, faced potential reductions. Meanwhile, the Imperial Irrigation District, which was hogging 85% of California's rightful share of the water, realized it was vulnerable to cuts. This mutual concern about future supplies led urban areas and Imperial to begin negotiations for the grand solution. In 2003, the State Water Resources Control Board approved Imperial's sale of nearly 20% of its water to San Diego, the Metropolitan Water District, Greater Los Angeles, and the Coachella Valley Water District, think Palm Springs and Palm Desert, for up to 75 years. The largest transfer of water rights from agricultural to urban interests in U.S. history.